Blog Talk Radio.
To be revealed.
Welcome back to the Impatient with Desire online book club broadcast. This is broadcast number 2. If you're not already participating in the IWD online book club, you can find us at goodreads.com. It's a private group on there. You can also send in an email, and we can hook you up with all the benefits that come with that, including a copy of the paperback edition of Impatient with Desire, The Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner, to be released by Voice Hyperion next Tuesday, March 15th. And we're on the line right now with author Gabrielle Burton and her daughter. Burton, you got
her
there?
Hi.
Yeah, hi. How
are
you doing?
Yeah, great. Well, last week we had a wonderful discussion, and it was really nice to hear the voice of one of our members. It was called in. He was a little bit behind the curve of the conversation. I don't think he was listening to the beginning of it because we kind of had to go over two things. But that's all right. If anybody wants to call in. Now, the number is 626-414-3413. That's 626-414-3413. And before we get into things, I think, maybe we should have started off with this last week, but I think it'd be wonderful if you could just give us a little bit of a reading from the book. And something that will set things up so people who maybe haven't read it yet or whatever can just get a handle on what's going on.
All right. Shall I just start reading from the beginning, maybe, a little bit? Or
yeah, why don't you set up exactly what you're going to be reading and what's going on, and then just go right in.
Okay. Now, it's known from history that Tamsin Donner kept a journal, but her journal was lost. And Impatient with Desire is her journal as I imagined it. Particularly, it's set during the almost four and a half months that she was trapped in the Sierra Nevada mountains with her husband, who had a grievous wound on his hand, and he was dying, and she had 5 daughters, and they were all starving. And so the journal goes back and forth. It's set there, but it goes back often to her early life. And I'll just start at the beginning, 1846. Imagine all the roads a woman and a man walk. Until they reach the road, they'll walk together. I never intended to marry again after Tully died. It wasn't for lack of chances, but that's nothing to boast about. In Ohio and in Illinois, even an outspoken woman like me has her pick of men. Most of those men were barely older than my Thomas would have been had he lived. Some women marry those boys, and I say to each his own, each your own, but young or old were not for me. I thought I had buried my heart with Tully. I met George Donner in a cornfield, and the beginning wasn't auspicious. And then it goes on about their meeting, and eventually you discover that she's sitting at the table writing while everybody else is sleeping. And she said, "We came here November 2nd, 1846, the day before we were trying to outrun a sudden fierce snowstorm. My sister-in-law and I and our older children walking ahead of the wagon to spare the oxen, our eyes on the looming mountains. My little Frances was bravely trudging along, and I said, every step we take gets us closer to California. The huge flakes fell faster, thicker, and suddenly a sharp crack rent the air. I turned, saw the broken axle, the wagon heaving sideways, started running, screaming, the babies. But George and Jacob were already pitching things out of the overturned wagon. They reached Georgia first, screaming, scared, but unhurt. Then Jacob uncovered Eliza and put her limp body in my arms. For a terrible second, I thought she was dead, and I thought I will not be able to bear it. Then she opened her eyes and began screaming. We all laughed with relief. It was November 1st, my 45th birthday, and I gave thanks that Eliza was unhurt, and I did not have to hold a dead baby in my arms a third time. All my life, I never had enough time, and now I have nothing but time. I'll stop there. But that will give you an idea of how they got there, and then you'll find out what happens once they get there.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it there's been a lot of it's been some interesting stuff that's gone on the book club site, but one of the most recent ones that came from Pat is you know, she mentions this little line about living in a civilized society, but that our nature is so primitive, and you know, I think one of the things that really struck me about going back in time with this is that I mean, we talked about last time too, the children that were part of this, and how mortality rates were so high, and just I think the value of life was a lot different.
Yes, well, Tamsin Donner was George Donner's third wife. He had already buried two wives, and he had 10 children, and then they had three more who went with them on the Oregon Trail. She had already buried a husband and two children, and this was you know, not uncommon in those years. Mortality was mm-hmm. very high of children. She says in one of her letters about her first son, "If he lives, I shall very much desire he has a northern education." So there's that, if he lives, you know, they're mm-hmm. they're hoping that that will happen. And one of the problems with the Donner Party was that 81 people were trapped in the mountains, and 41 of them were children mm-hmm. under 14. So that was what made it especially difficult for rescuers to get to them, because there weren't enough rescue, too many children.
So, I mean, I don't think there are as many people today losing multiple spouses or multiple children at this kind of rate. I mean, you remember we talked last week about toughness and all that. I just think if one incident of that happened to me, I'd be devastated, and let alone multiple.
I think that that's also part of, though, something where we realize our privilege. This is Gabrielle, the daughter, and I just finished Shanghai Girls by Lisa C, and it's made me think, and then I went to a Chinese restaurant, and I've known this guy who works there, and my husband sort of refers to him as professionally beleaguered, he seems. And yet, having read about an immigrant story where they go through such sacrifice and so many things happening that, as you say, each single one of them would seem earth-shattering to us. And that's obviously a book of fiction also, and she's combining a lot of people's true experiences into one experience. Yet I think that that's something that it helps for us to reflect on how lucky we each are today in mm-hmm. this country particularly. I mean, certainly in Darfur, people are undergoing horrific things now every day, and losing children and losing spouses and losing their own lives, or, you know, I think there's a lot of horrible things happening. And in this country, you think about people in Katrina who lost everything and lost family members, and we just don't know at any time when luck can strike in good or bad ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's so true, that most Americans, we are so privileged, because just in 100 years, I mean, at the end of the 18th century, 1900, mortality rate was 45. I guess died, and now, you know, if somebody died at 45, we would just think that was far too young. And in other countries, many, many, many children die before their first birthday. It's just that, you know, we're away from that, most of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that it almost gives you a sense of responsibility to living up to the opportunity that we have been given by the people before us who sacrificed. And I think there are a lot of people who come to this country who are immigrants who are sacrificing all the time, and going through that same experience that the Donners had of sacrificing for the sake of an opportunity, a better opportunity for their children. And that's one thing that's very interesting. I think it'd be interesting to hear listeners and people in the book club call in or email in their comments about, you know, have they gone through that kind of experience? And it could even be in on a smaller scale, but of doing something that they think is for a better opportunity, but that it goes hand in hand with a hardship or a sacrifice.
Well, I don't know if it's about a hardship or sacrifice, but let's go to the phones right now. All right,
hello?
You're online with Gabrielle Burton with the Impatient with Desire Online Book Club.
Hey, my name's Susan. I'm from San Francisco. I'm wondering, actually, about the format of the book. I thought it was interesting that you chose to use, like, journal entries and then letters and all those different things, and I'm wondering why you chose to write the book in that way and sort of, I really like it. I thought it made it read really smoothly, but I'm wondering why that instead of just a novel about the Donner Party.
Thank you, Susan. That's a good question. I never had any, I always wanted to write it as a journal because of her losing her journal. And if we had that journal, you know, we really don't know what happened there in the mountains. We're never going to know that, and that's what everybody wants to know. And at a certain point, you just have to turn to imagination about that. And I wanted it to be her journal because I wanted this. A lot of things have been written about the Donner Party, but I wanted it from a woman's viewpoint and also a mother's viewpoint of someone being there where she really just has her journal to talk to. Her husband is dying, and he's very brave, and they love each other, but it's not really a situation where they can talk about their fears all the time, and certainly not with their children. So she needed some outlet. And as far as the letters, through her life, she had corresponded with her sister, Betsy, who had stayed home, who was 9 years older, and Betsy had always asked her to tell the details of every place that she had been because Tamsin was the traveler. And so that's why I picked those two things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. I like it a lot. I like the way that makes it read. So thank you. Yeah.
Did you want, I had a friend who asked me actually the same question, Susan. This is Gabrielle, the daughter. And she had said she sort of wanted a third person narrator to tell us sort of the answer to these things and to give kind of a view that within someone's head they couldn't give. And in talking to her, I was saying, well, don't you think that in a sense that puts you in the immediacy of the experience, that you're there in the mountains and you're inside that person's head, and that's really compelling and interesting to think about those choices. And then, of course, as a reader, you can kind of separate yourselves and, from it. What did you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely thought, and like you guys were talking about earlier, about the sort of differences in regards to human life and how easily it was lost. I thought that's really struck home with me when I was reading it, is that, you know, it's a lot of times, I mean, she does express emotion about it, obviously, but a lot of times it is matter of fact that, like, this person died here, this person died here. And I thought that was really interesting that you were in her head. And I did like that there was the journal entries and that I sort of got to feel what someone in that situation would feel. I was just wondering, you know, it's a pretty strong choice to write a book in that kind of format. And so I was sort of wondering that. The thought process behind it while you were crafting the book, you
mm-hmm.
know. Yeah.
Well, that kind of leads to something we were talking about Mom, with the, as a work of fiction, you had the letters to go from, and how do you then go to embellish those letters and to creating the rest of the voice? You've obviously researched this for 38 years, so there's a lot of information that went into it. But how do you take that leap? And maybe that's sort of what Susan's getting at, too.
Well, it evolved over many, many, many years. It started out in the 70s as a very small little section of a large modern novel that was never published. But that was also her journal that a modern woman was reading, and there were perhaps 20 pages of her journal. I tried many, many times to tell the story in different ways, and eventually, originally I was trying to tell the story of the whole Donner Party. And there are 87 members, and they all have wonderful stories. But I finally realized that I admire historians greatly, but I didn't want to be a historian. I didn't want to tell everybody's story. I really wanted to capture Tams and Donner's spirit. And when I got to that point, that freed me then to just try to think about what that experience was like for her without any of all those other people. And I was lucky enough to write a nonfiction book first, Searching for Tams and Donner, in which I could put down a lot of the history and also Tamsin's 17 letters. And that was all the facts. And then when I ran out of facts, I had to turn to imagination. And that's how Impatient with Desire really happened.
Were there any, I mean, I think I asked you this before. I mean, if a journal is technically epistolary, which is a very has a long history in literature, the epistolary novel, are there any that stand out in your mind as possible influences?
Well, Tyson, I'm really sorry to say this, but I've never really cared much for epistolary novels.
Really?
I mean, probably it's my ignorance, and I haven't read the best one. But when I pick up a book and it starts out and it's letters or it's emails or it's whatever it is, it's like
it's a turn off for.
Yeah. So no, not that I know of. I can't say that. I think it's like I told Susan. I mean, I think it's mostly because she always wrote her sister the details, and so the journal she's telling herself, and at a certain point it turns into she's telling her sister too, and it becomes a letter in itself.
Yeah.
But it's not that form exactly.
No, the title comes from the letter to her sister, right, Mom?
Yeah, it is.
Tell about that letter.
Well, if we have time a little later, I could read a little bit of that letter, because there's 17 letters that are known to be in existence. There may be more, but those are the ones that we know. And that is a particular letter that when she was 23, she went off on a great sailing ship from Massachusetts to North Carolina, and this was a time when women didn't travel alone. And let me read a tiny bit of that, because it gives you a little flavor of Tams and Donner. So this is in 1824, and she's going for a teaching job, and she says, "Thus, my sister, one half of my journey is accomplished, and I leave it on record for the benefit of those who may wish to follow my example, that so far from considering me an outlaw, people of all stamps, from the senator, author, and southern planter downward, have treated me with attention and respect. And though they have sometimes wondered at my conduct, they have never despised me, and I never shall be despised." And then she goes on, that despised is a little bit strong. We think of it now in a different word, but she means basically they didn't disrespect her. And then she says, "I do not regret, nor shall I, the fatigue, expense, nor embarrassment to which I have subjected myself. My heart is big with hope and impatient with desire." And so that's what the title comes from, because it pretty much sums up Tams and Donner. And, of course, originally it's desire in the sense of eagerness, impatient with desire. And then later on, when she is trapped and she has a long time to think about things, it's there's another meaning to it, that what that desire has led her to, impatient with that desire. Not that she would necessarily have made a different choice, but just that she is now seeing more ramifications of her choice.
Susan, are you still there? Do you have any other questions?
No, Susan's off the line.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But, it's funny that you bring up such background on the title, because that has been an issue, getting the word out about this book a little bit, And in the paperback edition, you did add a subtitle, The Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner. I mean, which it didn't have before. What's some of the feedback that came back when the hardback? That was a lot of backwards there. I'm sorry. when the book originally came out in hardcover and it was just called Impatient with Desire, a novel. I mean, what did people think? Was it misrepresented in a certain way? And
that's what some people on the internet thought. A lot of blogs reviewed it or discussed it, and some of them originally had been a little put off. They thought that the book was a steamy romance, and so they didn't want to read that. Not that there's anything wrong with steamy romances, but that just wasn't their thing. And then when they found out it was this other book, they thought, well, why a misleading title? In my head, again, once they said it, I could see that, of course, but I never, ever, ever thought that, nor, you know, did the publishers. I'm glad that the subtitle is on the paperback now so that people will, be drawn to Tamsin Donner.
It's one of those titles, I think, that people come down in one camp or another, and it seemed that some people were adamant that they absolutely love the title. It's perfect. You know, it's something that really appealed to them, and other people thought it was misleading. And so in the paperback, that we should describe the covers to people, in the hardback, there's I think it's the Sierra Mountain, Nevada Mountains, or some very rocky mountain range, and sort of a gray, black and white tone on the top of the book, very beautiful kind of silver gelatin print, it looks like. And then the bottom half is these lush flowers from a kind of romantic period painting in red and white and orange and green leaves. And then over the book, it has this leaf embossing. And then in the paperback, Hyperion redesigned it to be at the back of a woman who's in a kind of, would you call it calico? What is that?
Yeah.
Kind of a calico, yellow, golden-toned cover, and she's in a dress with flowers striped up and down, and her hands are resting. They're very kind of strong working hands that are resting behind her back.
And
so
it's only her torso.
Yes,
it's as if you're an extreme close up on her, and then it has the subtitle.
And on the back, you also asked to add, Mom, the description of the book a little more detailed. Which happened because of a meeting with a man who represented book sales in the West, right?
Well, I met a sales rep at a convention, and he was saying that sales reps had 30 seconds to sell a book. And he said, if I get my first 10 seconds, then I'll get the second 10 seconds. And if I get that, I'm pretty sure I'm going to have the third. And he said, it's absolutely imperative that I know what the book is about so I can just go in there and in my 10 seconds get that out. And so I showed him, the cover of the book, and he said, that's beautiful. What's it about? And then he turned it over, and on the back there are all these blurbs, and it's still beautiful. And he said, nice blurbs. What's it about? And so my daughter Jennifer.
You're saying a rep, they go to bookstores, like Borders.
Yes, a representative.
So
they go to
bookstores.
Yes, it's like they cover whole states, and they go to the distributors who then supply the book stores. And
obviously, that's key for a book getting to readers, is if it's available, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So my daughter Jennifer and I went off. This was at the Western Writers of America convention in Tennessee, and we went off and we started doing some two sentences, and we went back to this guy and said, now we'll buy you a drink if you go over these sentences. And so he did, and he really liked this one, which was our favorite too, the Donner Party. You know how some died, here's how some lived. And he said, that's great. And of course he loved the idea of the subtitle. But the thing on the back was to also take it away from the cannibalism, because that's really, to me, the least interesting part, but that's the part that most people think of. So
yeah,
that's
you can't
how
ignore it, but
those,
but
yeah.
But
that's
well,
how
let's
all those
let's see.
I think
what
it'd
the,
be really interesting, Tyson, if people wanted to call in and talk about the comparison of the covers and sort of, you know, what appeals.
Yeah, well,
to
we have a caller from Massachusetts. Welcome to the Impatient with Desire Online Book Club broadcast number 2.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hello? Hi, it's Meg Robertson calling. Hello, Gabrielle and Gabrielle.
Hello.
Hello. How are the both
How
of you?
Are you?
Good.
I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm excited to talk with you about the book, Gabrielle. I have been wanting to ever since I read it. And, you know, I think the question that you just posed about the difference in the titles is very interesting, and I have a thought about that, and then I have one other thing that just has stirred in me since I read your book. So, I mean, briefly, I like the hardbound cover much better because, to me, it presents what she was longing to do. You know, and an image of a woman holding her hands behind her back to me is more pent-up desire and aspiration that, you know, particularly with that very old-fashioned kind of dress, you know, how many women held their hands behind their backs in those years and weren't able to do what they wanted to do, you know? So I understand that people needed to have a clear understanding of what the book is to take the leap to read it. But I still prefer the first. But the thing that I've been wanting to tell you that it was that?
I was going to say, those are not the writer's decisions. There are a lot of people that hold up in offices and decide, should the dress be yellow or blue?
Yeah.
So,
and how do we get people to buy this book?
I love the hardback.
Right.
Yeah. I love the hardback.
Yeah.
So
I really do, too. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, just, you know, the thing that really stirred in me is the decisions of parents to follow their dreams and their desires and sometimes the unintended consequences on their children. Because what was so wrenching to me about the story and how you made it come alive was, you know, her sending her children off into the mountains and never getting to meet them again. And just, you know, the thought that she had about that as she was there, you know, with her husband and eventually dying, you know, it's just, I think it's something that people wrestle with a great deal, people who cross borders to try to find a new life for their family and their unintended, you know, ramifications for their children growing up in poverty or growing up, you know, and the dreams that we want to aspire to our dreams because it's hopeful and we don't want to limit what we as people do. And I think also it's a goal for our children. But sometimes it doesn't work out for us, and it's a wound for our children. It just was really deep for me to read that and hear her wrestling with that in some ways in the book. So beautifully, beautifully written. Just wanted to say thanks for that.
Thank you, Meg. Certainly, you know, part of it is on one level about the struggle between a woman's being adventurous and her responsibility to her family. And I think that most modern wives and mothers just throw in the towel on the adventure part, never even considering it, but still face the same struggle between work and love. And that's something we just, you know, once children enter the picture, it becomes a whole different ball game. So it's something that's still with us. And I think it's so true about your decisions affect your children so much. I mean, people's political decisions, you know, if they sometimes expose their children to those, and of course you do, and you teach your children your beliefs and your values, but then your children have to go out and stand up against other people who believe differently. And all of these things are very difficult for parents, and as you say, often make wounds both for the parents and for the children.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, what is... Really
but I mean, would her children? I don't know. I just think about, you know, as you were. I mean, you've worked on this book for so many years and thought about her for so many years. How did you come to write her in that way that she, in some ways, it seemed like had some real peace with it at the end?
Well, I hope she did. I think she always intended to get out. One of her daughters later writes in a letter that mother was surprised how long father lasted. And that sounds, you know, in one way a little ghoulish to us, but I think of it in a different way that, you know, he's incredibly strong. I mean, he had a wound that should have killed him, you know, months before, and he just kept on. And I think, you know, that was part of her great admiration for him. But on the other hand, she stayed with him, because if she hadn't stayed with him, he would have been alone in the mountains all by himself, dying. Mm-hmm. And nobody would want to be faced with that choice, but she was faced with that choice. And so she sent her older daughters out first and to get things ready, and then she sent the younger three out somewhat in a panic because the rescuers who had come in were abandoning them all. And I think at that point, you know, she thought, wow, you know, I've got to get them out of here too. And then I think she had every intention of following mm-hmm. them, but it just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm. And on the flip side of the, you were saying, on the other hand, of parents making these choices that can be problematic for their children or have their tentacles reaching in ways that they didn't expect. It also works the other way, that parents can often make these choices as sacrifices, like her doing that. And there she makes a choice to send her daughters out in a sort of panic, but it does allow them to live. And they mm-hmm. lived very, very long lives into their 80s, right? And they
yeah.
have descendants alive today. And so in a sense, that choice, you know, allowed them to have extremely long and fulfilled lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I so enjoyed reading it, and I have to sign off, but it's been fun listening in and now getting a chance to talk a little bit about it. All right.
Thanks for calling.
Great. Best wishes for the new release.
Meg. Okay. Bye. Thanks, Meg.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Meg went to school with one of my daughters, so
oh, yeah?
we go back a long way.
No, this sort of transitions to something I wanted to, I didn't mean to say that. Yes, Meg is my friend. And it's so nice you called in, Meg. So I wanted to say that you wrote, it is something that Meg said that made me think of it, but you wrote this quote that I think is very interesting. There are a few primary sources and countless contradictory secondary sources which started to appear soon after the event of the Donner Party and continued to the present. It is my deep wish that the reader come to see all these people as real, their ordeal, almost buried by morbid jokes, instead become alive. And I think that connects really with what Meg's saying also about the choices that, you know, Donner was having to make. You have a choice as a writer to present this story in a myriad of ways. And there's a kind of responsibility that you feel to honor the dead here, and without sounding like this is a horror movie expression, but sort of bringing them alive at the same time. How did you balance that for yourself as a writer?
Well, for a lot of years, I was actually paralyzed with the notion of just writing directly about Tamsin Donner. I think maybe that's why it took me so long to evolve different forms and, you know, move away from just straight history. Take that responsibility of trying to imagine what this woman's life was like, because and it was a terrible responsibility, because she was a real person. It isn't like just making up a character in a novel, and she has descendants. And I was so afraid that I would not do her honor. I was so afraid that I would get it wrong, and I had to just work through that for a long time, until at a certain point I didn't think about it anymore. I just, I think I felt that I admired and respected her so much that it would all work out okay.
Uh-huh. Tell about, do we have time, Tyson, I wanted to talk about a different story if we have time about the legacy of Tamsin and the people
Please.
Who are still alive today.
I think that'd be really helpful.
Do you want to talk, Mom, about that and sort of how people have contacted you and how amazing that is that here 150 years later this is connecting to people who were related to her?
Yeah, I've heard from several descendants, and one of whom her name is Tamsin Eustace, which was Tamsin's birth name. And that was funny to get an email from Tamsin Eustace. But she's, you know, way, way, way down the descendant. And another descendant of Georgia Downer through the daughter, Georgia Downer, from Oregon, one in Connecticut, one in Oregon, and several. And the interesting thing is that some of these people, although they've always known that they've been related to the Downers, it just was something it didn't mean that much to them. And I say that, and of course it meant something to them, but they just didn't really think about it very much. But then at a certain point in their lives, I think like all of us do, you start valuing these things and you start wondering about these things. And they began reading about it. I'm very happy that in one case my book led a descendant to read about it. And I heard from one descendant who said, I'm sure you emailed me. She heard a review on the radio, and she tracked me down, and she said, I'm sure you have an opportunity to see many Downer relics, but would you be interested in seeing Tamsin Downer's cash box? And I was like, wow, would I be interested? And she actually came from Oregon to California to show me that cash box. And I knew the story of the cash box, which she didn't, because Eliza Downer, who was Tamsin's little daughter, wrote a book when she was grown up. And in that book, let me read that a little bit. The Downer children had kind of a sad upbringing. It all turned out okay, but they were separated for 15 years. And the two littlest ones were taken in by a strict couple who worked them pretty hard, and they called her Grandma. And Eliza writes about they really didn't have anything much from their mothers. They said they had their older sister had given them a pair of beautifully knit black silk stockings marked near the top in cross stitch D, and under that 5. The stockings had been our mother's. One of those is at the Huntington Museum. She had knit them herself and worn them. Georgia gave one to me and kept the other. We both felt that they were almost too sacred to handle. They were our only keepsakes. Later, Eliza goes on, later, Georgia found a small tin box in which Mother had kept important papers. She said, Grandma, for a long time, had used it for a white sugar box and kept it on a shelf so high that we could see it only when she lifted it down, and I don't think we took our eyes from it until it was put back. We felt it was too valuable for us ever to own. One day I found it thrown away. One side had become unsoldered from the ends, and the bottom also was hanging loose. With a full heart, I grasped the treasure and put it where we could often see it. Long afterwards, Harry Huff kindly offered to repair it, and the solder that still holds it together is also regarded as a keepsake from a dear friend. Now, Eliza Downer wrote that in the she was 68 years old, so it was the early 1900s. And the woman brought that box that had passed down through Georgia Downer somehow in Oregon all the way down to her, and sitting on my dining room table, and I knew it immediately because it was soldered at all the sides. It was exactly the box. And so I ran and got this book and read that section to her, and it was very, very exciting.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Those are things that when you write a book, you know, I mean, you send a book out there and it sort of ripples in the water, and you never know, it's out of your control, and you never know what'll happen. And that's a wonderful thing that happened from my writing this book. And there are probably other, you know, Downer artifacts. The letters, I discovered Tamsin Downer's letters somewhat similarly, but that was a while ago. And in the box there were artifacts, you know, there was a chip of china from one of the cabins and various things that this woman, Suzanne,
from one of the cabins in the mountains.
In the mountains. This woman's grandmother had really, really valued that box and Suzanne, the woman I met as a little girl, had always liked the box best, and so her grandmother, when she died, put a note on it that was to go to Suzanne. And so a lot of these things probably get thrown out, you know, but that somebody knew the worth of that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow. And do you think there are other things out there that people could possibly have in their basements or their attics that are very valuable to the story?
Yeah, and to other stories, too.
Yeah.
I think so. I know that when I went to the Donna Party Sesquicentennial, and this is in 1996, the 150th anniversary at Donner Pass, and there was a descendant there, and she was talking about one of Tamsin's letters, and I went up to her afterwards and said, I thought I knew all the letters, but I never heard of that. And she said, oh, well, they always were in the family, and we just gave them to the Huntington Museum. Now, they gave like 10 letters that nobody had even known were around, and I was lucky and privileged enough to work with those letters. But I know there are things that people haven't given. Well, this box, for example, it's not in a museum, and it's just lucky that Suzanne heard about the book and contacted me so I could see it and know that it exists.
And that also impacted her, was it her daughter?
Yeah.
You said, of feeling that sense of responsibility to history, right?
She brought her 15-year-old daughter, and I said, I'm so impressed that you are so interested in history. And she said, well, it's really just this history, she said. But she was tremendously moved that she really grasped that she was a relative of those brave people.
Yeah, incredible. And that's where history can be lost, as people just don't know what the context is. And, you know, knowing that context makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Is there anything specific out there that you know from doing your research that you want to get your hands on?
Well, there was a pen in this box and mm-hmm. that Suzanne brought. And to me, that pen, I just immediately coveted that pen. I just was so drawn to that pen. And I said to Suzanne, you know, that could be Tamsin's pen. And mm-hmm. and we just sort of stared at it, and I held it. And then when I Googled pens, it was an 1840s pen. But, of course, nobody really will know if it's her pen or it isn't her pen, because all kinds of Donner descendants have handled that pen.
But
I'd love
that
pen.
DNA doesn't work, right?
But the pen should, all the contents, they should all ultimately go to some museum so everybody can see them.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to talk about the bone, the stone. Would you be interested
No.
There's a story in the other book, Searching for Tamsin Donner, that talks about moms going to the camp where they were and spending the night there and finding a stone, which, you know, was for a while considered maybe it could be a bone, and, you know, was analyzed and stuff, and yet then it was found out that it wasn't. It still held this incredible significance in our whole family of something that, you know, is from the site, and for a while there was thought that maybe it actually was a relic, and it still can be that way, you know, emotionally, and it's a really...
Well, it made me give up smoking, so that's why my family also cherished it, because it gave me the strength to give up smoking.
Which was great.
But I'm sure there are many other artifacts around. They still find some things in the site. They were doing an archaeological dig, but the grant money ran out, so they, you know, had to stop, but I'm sure there are things there. I mean, they found coins and buttons and various things from the Donner Party.
There are also probably going to be things that are just in people's attics.
Yeah, I think absolutely. The same way that this ended up in Oregon, you know, people don't really, we connect them with California, but somehow that one daughter got to Oregon.
Hmm.
Or if she didn't, you know, her descendants did, and they took that box with them.
It's amazing to me. I just think about the discussions over the generations about what the deal is, is with the box and what it actually was, and you know, it's all. I think of like a game of telephone, where family members are saying, you know, this is this and that's that, and you know, without actually doing very hard research from it.
Well, here is another part. So when Suzanne came, she said, one time the box had Tamsin Donner's rings in them, her wedding rings. And I think they were given to my cousin, who was named Tamsin. And so she tried to track that all down. And then just recently, a couple weeks ago, she emailed me that her cousin, who had recently moved his aged mother someplace, said, I saw a small box labeled Tamsin Donner's rings, and I will take pictures of its contents and send them all to you. And well, that hasn't happened yet, but there's something else, like the rings.
Yeah. Incredible. A book can make these people think about that, too. It's so, so tenuous, and, you know, sort of what a chance that she happened to read your book, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
a little box that people are moving around that says Tamsin Donner's rings. I mean, wow, you know.
would you ever tackle another historical figure? I mean, I think everybody knows that you're pretty obsessed with this topic, and you may not be done with it. But what are some other historical figures that you've been interested in?
Well, I don't think I would, Tyson. I think I'm ready to get off the Oregon Trail, except if the miniseries say that would give me an opportunity to go into some of the other characters, because there was one man, Charles Stanton, who went out twice and brought back a rescue to them and ultimately dies, and he was so brave, and the rescuers were so brave. There's so many people who have wonderful stories, what happened to the children, but not a book. I'm not going to do another book on this. I'm going to move to some other place. And I don't even feel I'm obsessed with her anymore. I mean, I feel that we're both at rest on that. I feel that I've done what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Except for the movie. What you're working on.
and the sequel and the...
Yeah.
But, I went back and read A Heartbreak Hotel, and it doesn't surprise me that that you excuse me have stayed on with these characters that are surrounded by so much devastation. I mean, I think obviously I'm thinking of the character of Quasimodo, and about what is it about people's struggle that really draws you in?
Well, I've never really thought about that book in relation to this book, but I've always been very interested in the different selves that we have. And if you think of that in the context of Tamsin Donner or the pioneers, I mean, the people that you can become. I mean, you can go one way or you can go the other way. And I've always been very interested in endurance. Even as a teenager, I would read all those books. And how do people survive adversity? And could I do that if I were in that situation? And Terry Anderson, the other ones in Beirut, and who were captured, Jacobo Timmerman, all these people who were imprisoned long times, who survived, but how did they do that? That's just I don't know why I'm like that, but that's just something that's always been of deep interest to me. I was just thinking along those lines. also almost going back to something that Gabrielle said, but I had a wonderful opportunity when I lived in Malaysia to work at the Vietnamese Boat People's Camp. And talk about survivors. I mean, those people just had endured tremendous hardship to get there, you know, coming on boats, pirates attacking them, some living, some not. And then in this camp, some would be there for 5 years until a country would take them. And so it was like a little town, not a big town really, you know, 20,000 people. And just the resilience of the human spirit. And that's, of course, what I was, I think Tamsin Donner had, a resilience in the midst of
that was on one of the discussions on Goodreads, actually, about, I looked at this one entry, here it is. Debbie said, on the toughness idea, it brings to mind Stones into Schools by Greg Mortensen and his stories of the Kyrgyz, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Oh, sure.
Kyrgyz people who live at the outermost reaches of an inhabitable land, isolated from everything, and of Sarfraz and the others who accomplished the mission of building schools in hard-to-reach places in Afghanistan and Pakistan. These are tough people, and a lot of it is expectations and mindsets. And that kind of then led other people to talk about, well, what is, you know, is it sort of an animal state, or is there humanness?
That
you know, you're led to when you're in such extreme things, situations, and you know, survival.
Well, let me bring in a caller here. This is Marn from West Hollywood. Marn, hey, welcome to the show. You're on live.
Oh, hi, Tyson.
Hi.
Wow. let's wake up today and get on the radio. So.
Yeah.
Really? There is a book you're talking about.
Yes, yes. Impatient with Desire, The Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner.
Oh, that? Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And and you stumbled across the Facebook post and
right, exactly.
Sent me a message saying, send me more information. I want to call
exactly.
in.
Exactly. Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, so you... You may be a little out of topic, but we're talking about specifically Tamsin Donner and the struggle of the entire Donner Party coming west.
Right. I have some familiarity with it. After all, I've lived in the West all my life. I was born in Reno, and so the entire Donner Pass geographically is something that I. You know, I mean, I've been over it. And yes, well, you know, Tyson, my experience with researching historical figures is really limited to researching, and again, limited, in a limited way, for my book about Emily Dickinson, The Rape and Recovery of Emily Dickinson, in her words, and Poems of Witness and Worth. And what I mean limited is that I didn't have access to primary sources, but I certainly made the most of secondary, and I read all of the available biographical materials, you know. But back to Impatient with Desire, and you just need to be really, really careful and conscientious. I mean, that I think is really the marrow or the bone of scholarship, and no matter, you know, what you're doing. You know, I was thinking, is there any kind of parallel at all between the subject of my book, Emily Dickinson, and anybody of the Donner Party? And, you know, there is quite a parallel because of the shame of supposed cannibalism or, in fact, cannibalism, and the survivors needing to live that down. And anyway, that's what came to my mind.
Well, hi, Marn. This is Gabrielle. I was just thinking that when you're talking in your book, which I haven't read, I'm sorry, but you're being a witness, right? Wouldn't you say that? That's part of when you go back with these figures and
Oh, you know, you're absolutely, that's true. That's an interesting dynamic involved. That's right. You are. And you absolutely, you do establish a relationship with your subject. I've noticed that with other biographers as well. I mean, they'll be parental, or they will be avuncular, or there will be a sibling, or an auntie, or a friend. But they do establish a relationship with their subjects.
Mhm. Mhm. Well, I look forward to reading your book.
Oh, I must say I will absolutely look forward to reading your book, Gabrielle.
Thank you.
Pre-published? I mean, he's quite right. I woke up not too long, about an hour ago, and I saw Tyson's post, and I thought, pre-pub book club. That's interesting. And
yeah.
So your book isn't actually out, is it?
Well, it's out in hardback. The paperback comes out next Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so
I see.
Next Tuesday. So that's what the pre-pub book club is.
Oh,
the paper. Wow.
Oh.
And then on Tuesday, the name of the club is going to change to the online book club, because we can't, of course, go forward with a pre-pub book club after pub.
Basically, the paperback coming out, there are a lot of book clubs who have been sort of waiting for the book clubs, for the paperback, so they would do it for their book club. And so that's kind of what this is aiming to do, continue that community and foster it and have people have a lot of interesting discussions around that.
Yeah, and it looks like we're reaching out. Thanks for calling in, Marn.
Oh, thanks for inviting
me.
Appreciate it. And nice to speak with you, Gabrielle, and I definitely will look out for your book. Bye.
Ditto here. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, we only have a couple minutes left, so, you know, the next time we're going to be broadcasting, it's going to be next Tuesday, which is the publication date of the paperback.
Yeah.
We're going to do it the same time, which is 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time, and you'll be able to call in at the same number, 626-414-3413. And just real quick, Gabrielle, I mean, what are you going to be doing that day? Do you have special champagne toasting plans? Or
absolutely. Well, I'm going to be doing a radio blog in the morning, talk radio, and then I'm going to probably go around to some bookstores and see my book there. And then the champagne.
Very nice. Well, we should coordinate, hopefully.
Champagne?
Some champagne. You know, I don't have one of those vehicles that you can actually drink alcohol in, like in the back seat, like a limo. But maybe we can drive around together and we can hit a number of bookstores on Tuesday if you're free.
Get in the back seat of a Prius or something.
I think we better ride our bikes around together.
That's the LA version.
Yeah.
Did you know I just got a Prius?
No, I didn't, but that's just the Los Angeles version.
Oh, my God.
Prius, you know,
now I see them everywhere. Okay, well, thank you both for coming on. Again, the book is Impatient with Desire, The Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner. You can find us at our online book club at goodreads.com. Just search Gabrielle Burton or Impatient with Desire, and you should be able to find us. And we will
also join the Facebook group.
And join the Facebook group. And if you don't have the book already, go out and get it. If you do have it, go get some more. Pass them along to your friends.
Yeah, I think Amazon's running a special right now before the publication date, so that's pretty
exactly.
Get it this week, because it'll change as of next Tuesday. So
well,
that's
ask
right.
Your library. Ask your library. That
also
always helps.
Yeah, that's good.
And very
okay,
nice
well,
to be here, Tyson. I enjoyed it.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, ladies, and we'll talk to you all next week.
All right.
Have
bye-bye.
A great day.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
left you on a debris